Today is Thursday, April 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The World Health Organization addresses criticism over its handling of the pandemic.
No need to use COVID to score political points.
Plus, protecting vulnerable populations.
We really need to make sure that this crisis, and under the guise of public health, that asylum laws and refugee rights and the convention are respected.
And robots may be bringing food to you in the future. Those stories and more are next. This week, U.S. President Donald Trump lashed out at the head of the World Health Organization, who called for unity and global solidarity after Mr. Trump accused the U.N. agency of being China-centric and threatening to suspend funding. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikuswara starts us off.
At a time when the World Health Organization should be focused on dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, it's facing criticism from its biggest donor. U.S. President Donald Trump accused the WHO of not being aggressive enough in confronting the virus and threatened to suspend funding. In response, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called for unity and warned against politicizing the crisis.
No need to use COVID to score political points. No need. You have many other ways to prove yourselves.
So when he says politicizing, he's politicizing. That shouldn't be. But look, we spend $450 billion, $452 billion, almost $500 billion last year, hundreds of billions in previous years. And they got to do better than that.
Trump accused the WHO of being slow to react to the pandemic, despite it declaring COVID-19 as a public health emergency of international concern weeks before the U.S. declared a national emergency. Trump also accused it of being China-centric. The agency has praised China's response to the pandemic, and critics say it may have been too trusting of Beijing, who initially tried to conceal the outbreak in Wuhan. Robert Daly is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center.
There is both a legitimate concern here about the WHO perhaps pandering to China. There is some evidence of that, although it's to be determined. We don't really know. And then there's also a concern that perhaps the Trump administration is using this as a scapegoat to distract from its own rather late and ineffectual response.
On the same day Trump threatened to suspend WHO funding, the U.S. announced an additional $225 million to boost COVID-19 response efforts worldwide. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
That's on top of the roughly $274 million in funding we've already deployed to 64 countries across the globe.
Pompeo said the aid is part of U.S. continued global leadership in the pandemic, which some analysts view as lacking. Daniel Rundy is an international development analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
If we want to remain a global power, one of the things that the world expects us as a global power is to help solve this problem. We need to be seen as solving the global COVID problem, because if we aren't, China's going to happily step in and try and take the credit.
Publicly, Trump has welcomed China's global role in the pandemic. Earlier this month, he said that he views it as a positive if Beijing is helping other countries. Patsy Wittikuswara, VOA News.
The Saudi-led coalition that has been fighting Houthi rebels in Yemen for 5 years declared a 2-week ceasefire starting today in response to United Nations calls for peace as the world battles the coronavirus pandemic. After making his appeal last month, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said last week that parties to conflicts in multiple countries have expressed their acceptance, including those in Cameroon, Libya, South Sudan, Syria, and Ukraine. UN efforts are focused on not just for the sake of quieting those conflicts, but to give humanitarian groups and governments a better chance of delivering badly needed aid and to try to prevent the spread of the virus among some of the world's most vulnerable communities. The International Rescue Committee issued a new report calling attention to those issues. It specifically noted essential medical equipment that has been scarce in hard-hit places like the United States and parts of Europe, while many conflict-affected and fragile countries have virtually none to begin with. The report says only half of Yemen's hospitals are fully functional, while two-thirds of the country's population does not have access to health care. It also pointed to a shortage of intensive care unit beds and ventilators in South Sudan, northern Syria, and Venezuela. Worldwide, there are about 1.5 million confirmed cases of the coronavirus disease, with 89,000 deaths. Dr. Paul Siegel is an epidemiologist and public health specialist, and prior to serving as the director of Johns Hopkins University Centers for Humanitarian Health, he was a senior official with the UN Refugee Agency. He told VOA via Skype that governments shouldn't use the pandemic as an excuse to crack down on refugees or asylum seekers.
It can be difficult, and there's a concern that given this pandemic and everyone is looking inward, that certain governments may try to say, okay, now it's time that it's called refoulement, which means forcibly move refugees across the border back to where they came from. So we really need to make sure that this crisis, and under the guise of public health, that asylum laws and refugee rights and the convention are respected, because it would not surprise me if something like this does occur in some countries.
A concern he has is that the novel coronavirus would likely travel quickly in densely populated areas such as camps, where social distancing and isolation would be difficult.
We should not think about refugees as helpless people that just need our help. But a refugee remains a refugee for at least over a decade, and some say up to 17 years, so that they are there in these camps or these settlements, depending on the context. In many situations, they bring with them the same social environment, the same structures and cultural aspects as where they were living previously. So first and foremost is we have to explain to them what is happening right now, the COVID epidemic. And then we need to work with them and not just say this is what we should be doing, but how to change the programs that we're currently providing to refugees. And I'll explain that in a second, but also ask them how best to try to social distance in these settings. For example, we're talking about in many situations, we're considering moving some of the more vulnerable people into certain areas within smaller groups. But this may be completely unacceptable culturally for groups that are used to living multi-generational.
Spiegel added that another concern is that in many places, refugees do have access to healthcare centers or clinics, but those facilities themselves can pose a danger.
So we have to ensure that only those that really need to go to health centers where you can increase infection go, which means to start training more intensively community health workers. But then conversely, you have a lot less protective equipment. And so we're grappling with this idea of how do you, the health workers, and particularly those visiting households in these camps, how do we protect them? And will they quickly fall sick, and or will they become infectious and then infect others? There's this issue of task shifting that we're talking about now a little bit, but you're going to see your healthcare personnel. There are very few of them, and they're all going to have to task shift up, meaning they're going to be those that are not used to dealing with very sick patients are going to have to, those doctors, the few of them that exist, will have to deal with very sick patients. Nurses, and it's often quite an hierarchical healthcare system in many of these places, so nurses are not necessarily used to treating patients, but they're going to have to.
One area that Spiegel said needed to be addressed is how governments will address the use of limited resources. He noted that a decision needs to be made on whether or not to allow ICUs and ventilators to be used by patients in refugee camps or reserve them for nationals. Still to come on today's program.
Since they're robots, they can be trained to speak any different languages.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. Astronomer Edwin Hubble provided evidence that the universe was expanding back in 1929, and he came up with a unit of measurement called the Hubble constant to determine the rate of expansion. While scientists have disagreed with how fast the universe is expanding, most have long agreed that it's doing so in all directions and at the same rate, in a theory called the isotropy hypothesis. Researchers at the University of Bonn and Harvard University have released a new study that suggests the expansion of today's universe may not be uniform. Lead author Konstantinos Migas of the University of Bonn says he and his colleagues examined the behavior of over 800 galaxy clusters in the present universe. He suggests that if the isotropy hypothesis was correct, the properties of the clusters would all be even across the sky. But the researchers actually saw major differences. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. As the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak worsens in the United States, African-American individuals are being hit especially hard by the disease, with disproportionately high rates of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. One of the first U.S. cities to raise the alarm over this racial disparity was Milwaukee in the state of Wisconsin. VOA's Jason Patinkin has more.
The U.S. city of Milwaukee in the north-central state of Wisconsin reported its first COVID-19 infection March 13th. The city now has over 1,000 cases, but the data behind those numbers shows a disturbing trend. The city's health commissioner, Dr. Jeanette Kowalik, said African Americans make up only 37% of the Milwaukee population, but they're being infected, hospitalized, and killed by COVID-19 at much higher rates.
From week one, the percentage of African-American cases were, I think, about 70%. Now we're at about half. So African-Americans representing about half of the cases. But as far as people that are hospitalized due to COVID-19 infection, it's 62% African-American individuals, which is very high. And then as far as deaths, it's about 80%.
Similar trends are in cities around the country, from Detroit, Michigan to New Orleans, Louisiana. The Washington Post reported that in Chicago, Illinois, 68% of the city's COVID-19 deaths and 52% of its cases are among Black people, despite Black people making up just 30% of the city's population. Kowalik said the phenomenon reflects long-standing racist policies and practices toward African Americans in the U.S., leading to negative health outcomes. She said the higher rate of COVID-19 cases mirrors that of other health problems among African Americans. Kowalik said the phenomenon reflects long-standing racist policies and practices toward African Americans in the U.S., leading to negative health outcomes. She said the higher rate of COVID-19 cases mirrors that of other problems among African Americans.
When you look at infant mortality, obesity, lead poisoning, when you look at violence, you see very similar distributions of disease and impact. Until we fix the underlying issues, we will continue to see these distributions, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's a new outbreak, you name it. But when you have a group that has been chronically disadvantaged, and not by choice, but by force, that you're going to see these distributions today.
Kowalik said one of those underlying issues is lack of adequate housing for African American people, which forces more people to share the same roof in densely populated parts of cities, allowing COVID-19 to more easily spread. A legacy of discrimination in hiring, housing, and education has meant that about 22% of African Americans live in poverty, compared with 10% of whites. And in urban areas with large African American populations, there often is a shortage of high-paying jobs, trapping many in low-wage service industry jobs, including at grocery stores, sanitation, and public transportation, which have been deemed essential services. That means that while most people stay at home during COVID-19 lockdowns in the U.S., many Black people are still going out for work, putting them at higher risk of contracting the virus. Kowalik said the disease is killing African Americans at higher rates than other groups because African Americans also have higher rates of underlying health issues, making them more vulnerable. She said this is also a legacy of long-standing racial inequities in America that has resulted in unequal access to proper health care and nutrition.
heart disease or high blood pressure, diabetes. You know, we see African Americans suffering from these diseases that, you know, are rooted in these racist structures, policies, and practices. When you have these underlying conditions, you're more at risk for being hospitalized. You're more at risk for dying from COVID-19 infection than someone that doesn't have them.
The health commissioner said one way her city of Milwaukee is trying to overcome these inequities is by working to ensure that Black residents have enough necessities like food and medicine. That way, they won't need to risk infection by going out to work. She also encouraged businesses to allow sick workers to stay at home during the outbreak.
Don't let your sick people work. I know sometimes people are short-staffed and they really need everyone on deck, but don't risk infecting your entire workforce because you don't want to lose one person for a few days.
Kowalik stressed that everyone must take COVID-19 seriously, no matter their skin color.
Disease does not discriminate. Like when we have acute situations like this, whether it be coronavirus, any new virus, for instance, once it's new to a population, it's not discriminating. It can attack anyone that's a mammal.
COVID-19 has infected around 400,000 people in the U.S., killing about 13,000. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was getting better Thursday in intensive care, where he is battling COVID-19 as his government extended its overdraft facility and reviewed the most stringent shutdown in peacetime history. Hong Kong's Court of Appeal on Thursday ruled that a blanket government ban on face masks was unconstitutional at a time when most Hong Kong people are wearing them in the hopes of warding off the new coronavirus. Partially overturning a lower court's ruling, a three-judge panel said that while the government had the right to ban the wearing of masks at unlawful assemblies, a ban on masks at legal public gatherings was unconstitutional. After a brutal 10-year financial crisis, Greece was on course to a promising rebound. Businesses and exports were slowly but consistently growing, and tourism was booming. However, with the coronavirus, the biggest money-making industry for one of the European Union's weaker economies is in peril. Anti-Karasava reports tour operators and hoteliers are bracing for their worst season ever.
It was supposed to be a record year, with this tiny sun-kissed nation and its idyllic islands expecting three times as many travelers as its population of 11 million. Now, not even a single tourist with a hat and camera can be seen. Lysandros Tsilidis, the president of the Federation of Hellenic Associations of Travel and Tourist Agencies, portrays a devastated tourist industry. From inexpensive hostels to five-star resorts, he says, no one has been spared. Everyone is at zero. There is just no movement, nothing happening. All trips have been cancelled, all flights have been grounded. It's impossible to predict how and when it could all start up again. For a country for which tourism accounts for 25% of gross domestic product and where one in five jobs is linked to the trade, COVID-19 is exacting huge financial losses. The Greek economy is the European Union's second most reliant on tourism, after Cyprus, which makes it much more vulnerable and adds more hardship to a nation still reeling from a 10-year brutal recession. To offset some of the pain, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis's government has weighed in, affording billions of euros to businesses while subsidizing employees' salaries to prevent massive layoffs. On the popular island of Rhodes, though, where more than 2 million mainly British, German, and American tourists flock each summer, resort owners are now considering staying shut beyond the mandatory lockdown that ends later this month. Manolis Markopoulos, the head of the island's hotel owners, say resorts may have no other option than to shut down entirely for the season. They say cancellations are running at nearly 100% for May, and operating costs are too high to maintain in a crisis that has no clear end date. Early and rigorous actions taken by the Greek government have helped contain the spread of the coronavirus here. However, for travel to resume and tourism to kick off again, All countries must be free of the coronavirus, Tsilidi says.
Καραντίνα και travel δεν γίνεται.
Quarantines and travel just don't mix, he says. Which British national or German or American is going to travel halfway around the globe for a week's vacation in Greece, knowing he'll be quarantined for at least 14 days, he asks. To head off a complete collapse of the country's multi-billion dollar industry, officials say they will target domestic tourism more than ever, encouraging Greeks to rediscover their homeland once the virus is brought under control and travel regulations ease. Tsilidis says, though, it may take as much as 18 months for foreign travelers to set foot here again in organized forms of travel. Normality, he says, can only resume when people feel it's safe to travel again. That, he says, can only come from health experts and the World Health Organization when they announce a cure or vaccine for the coronavirus. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
Collaborative robots, known as cobots, are becoming a big business. Restaurants in the United States and in countries around the world are using robots at restaurants. BIS research says that in 2018, the cobot market registered a revenue of $580.8 million and is projected to reach $9.13 billion by 2024. VOA's Elizabeth Lee visited one restaurant in Los Angeles where robots work as a hostess and a waiter.
This robot hostess named Peanut asks guests to follow closely as it takes them to their table at this restaurant. Once the food is ordered, food is placed on this robot waiter, and off it goes, delivering ingredients to put into a boiling pot of hot soup at this Chinese hot pot style restaurant.
I think it's really cute and novel.
From serving up hot pot ingredients to sushi, there are approximately 22 of these robots from the China-based company Kinon Robots. Across the U.S., and almost 6,000 Kinon robots work around the world. And that's just one of many robot companies geared towards restaurants. This one only speaks Mandarin for now.
Since they're robots, they can be trained to speak any different languages.
There are sensors on the robot to help it navigate around a restaurant without running into things.
The infrared cameras, the laser dot camera, similar to the one used on your iPhone, and also other visual cameras that helps the AI inside to determine what this object is. Is this object moving? How fast is it moving? Is it going to collide with me?
Sensors locate these dots on the ceiling, serving as a GPS of sorts, guiding the robots around the restaurant's twists and turns. Yvonne Tam came to eat here because of the robots.
I thought it would be a more interesting experience. I don't know later on if it becomes a more common experience, how I would feel about it. I might want a human touch or human interaction.
Robots and automation in restaurants may become more common in the future as a cost-saving measure. For now, this hot pot restaurant still needs the human touch to serve guests, while the robots are just a fun way of bringing in the customers for a different kind of dining experience. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Disney's streaming service, Disney Plus, has racked up 50 million subscribers in just 5 months after its launch, giving rival Netflix something to think about. Reuters' Jillian Satterthwaite has those details.
Okay, everybody, let's take it from the top.
Disney was late to the video streaming game, but it's making up for lost time.
Something's happening.
The company says subscribers have passed the 50 million mark just 5 months after launch. No fewer than 8 million of those are in India, where the Disney Plus service rolled out only last week. Analysts say viewers have been won over by strong content. Besides the famous animated movies, Disney also owns franchises including Star Wars and the Marvel Comics movies. For now, it's still a long way behind rival Netflix, though. It has nearly 167 million paid subscribers in over 190 countries. But it will be watching its new competitor very carefully. Disney Plus is steadily spreading worldwide.
It's like a dream. A wonderful dream come true.
It rolled out to 8 European countries, including the UK, France, and Germany, over the past 2 weeks. And the timing could hardly be better. With seemingly the whole world stuck at home, demand for video streaming has never been higher.
That was Reuters reporter Julian Satterthwaite. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.